and welcome to Worlds Apart. The development of farce as a dramatic genre in the West has a long and storied history, having as much to do with food as with entertainment. But it got its biggest rise in the Middle Ages when playwrights started inserting unscripted buffoonery into religious plays. Similarly, the ascent of Donald Trump to the global political stage has pulled the rug from under many geopolitical conventions, leaving friends and foes both dumbfounded and scurrying to adjust to this new act. What to expect in the finale? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Anthony Moretti, an associate professor at the Department of Communication and Organizational Leadership of Robert Morris University. Professor Moretti, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Now, Trump is usually discussed as a political phenomenon, but he's also the product of the American popular culture. And in its best traditions, he's very unceremoniously erasing any boundaries between fiction and reality. Do you think the appearance of a political personality like him is a peculiar oddity, or was it in a way a natural development of political, social, and cultural processes in the United States?
I think it's both. And what I mean by that is, number one, there has rarely been a political figure, I don't care where you look in the world, who has been so willing to both, A, make so much about him or her, in his case, him, who has internalized so much, who believes that he has a unique set of characteristics or skills. You know, you may remember at one of his first political conventions, his famous statement, "I alone can fix it." And those five words have sort of stuck to him, both in terms of his supporters and his critics, in terms of they look at Trump and they say, yes, he is the man to fix it. And his critics will say, no, no one person can do that alone in the U.S. political system. But I also think it's fair to say that he is a cultural phenomenon. Like him or dislike him, you know, people have gravitated to that very in your face, very much a like on a constant attack mode. And so I think, yes, he is peculiar internally to the political system. But I think from a social standpoint, from a reality TV standpoint, if you will, I think there are a lot of people who say, this is exactly what we see on TV all the time. What's the problem?
But it's not only what we see on TV. I mean, if we look at the American foreign policy stance over the last couple of decades, I mean, I alone can fix it. Isn't that the ethos that the United States has been projecting for many decades? The shining city on the hill, you know, the benevolent hegemon, the, you know, God-given nation, etc. I mean, to some extent, he's very truthful to the message that the United States has been, you know, projecting to the rest of the world.
I think the difference is that presidents before him have been willing to, and this is a cliche, and I admit, but I'll use it, they've been willing to work within the system. And you know, Trump looks at the system and he sees it as dangerous. He sees it as perhaps reckless. He sees it as perhaps not always in line with simply what he expects and what he wants. And so his willingness to blow up the system, if you will, while keeping much of the American message intact is fascinating to watch in real time. And what I mean by fascinating is, you know, you think of a movie and you know it's scripted, you know it's going to last a couple of hours, you have a sense of where the narrative is going to end. With this being in real time, you're looking at you know, a stress test on the democratic system, and nobody with real expertise or just the proverbial man on the street can tell you exactly how this is going to end. And in some ways, that is a benefit to Trump because he seems to really thrive in a situation where chaos is paramount.
Professor Moretti, in one of your articles, you call Trump a man who fabricates false narratives to manufacture reality that cannot be supported by fact. And I would claim that most recent American leaders have done just that, sometimes with very gory consequences, like, let's say, Obama in Libya. But sure, they did it in more sophisticated, cultured, and polished ways. And I wonder, perhaps there's a value both for the world and for the American public in having somebody who is doing that in a more transparent or indeed more farcical and grotesque way.
There was an opinion piece written during Trump's first presidency that I thought was really fascinating. And it made the case that he might be the most honest U.S. president that America has had in however many generations, because he tells you what he's going to do. He generally does it. Yes, he'll back off if circumstances don't work right, whatever. I get that. But he is very much willing to be, very aggressive in terms of what he pursues. And I think where that frustrates the American political system is, again, that word you used a second ago. The sophistication is not there. The tact is not there. The ethical leadership that we would consider is not there. The poise is not necessarily there. But I do think there are legitimate questions to be asked when you strip away that poise or the absence of poise. If you strip away the sophistication, or say there's no sophistication at all, is there really any difference in terms of what the policy direction has been? And depending upon where you fall with Trump, you either say, look, he is changing the global system to benefit the United States, or he's changing the global system at the risk of damaging the entire global arena. And again, he's so black and white. He's either liked or loathed. And so as a result, there's very little middle ground in terms of trying to discuss what he wants to do.
Well, let me challenge you on that a little bit, because you wrote recently that under Trump's watch, everything is negotiable. And until recently, the Americans expected from their counterparts to agree to everything before the talks. They saw negotiations as a sort of a form of reward for good behavior. So when you say that under Trump, everything is negotiable, isn't that actually a positive development? Because it gives a little bit more room to diplomacy, to the art of negotiations or the craft of negotiations as the main sort of form of communication between states.
By just coincidence, I happen to be reading a book that was written a few years ago by Ronan Farrow called War on Peace. And it looks at how the U.S. State Department has been hollowed out over the last 30 or 40 years or so, maybe even a little longer. One of the arguments that he consistently makes is, if you're not talking, and I don't care if it's to an ally or to an enemy, if you're not talking, there are going to be problems that are going to develop. I think the difference, though, is that Trump looks at a negotiation from almost a finger-pointing standpoint. And what I mean by that is, here's what we're going to do. You're going to agree with me. You don't have a say in this, etc. Behind the scenes, though, his team tries to be much more subtle in terms of how they conduct that, how they conduct those policies. So in some ways, I think there is a fair argument to make that more talk is definitely good. I think what would make more countries comfortable with Trump and what he's attempting to do is if he would turn around and say, look, some of the global agreements and treaties and whatnot, I might not necessarily agree with, but instead of just automatically pulling America out of it, I'm going to seek to make some changes within the system. And that's the thing that frustrates people who dislike Trump so much, is he basically blows it up without necessarily thinking about the ramifications of that. Or maybe he has thought about the ramifications of it in advance. And to his critics, it's like, yeah, whatever. He doesn't care. He just wants to blow it up. It is a fascinating presidency to watch. There is no doubt about it, because so many of the rules and so many of the expectations just simply are not applicable right now.
Absolutely. And I think it's also fascinating to watch how friends and foes are adjusting to this new American president, because they are leveraging his bizarre or unpredictable behavior in very different ways, which is what I want to focus on right now, starting with China, because you are a specialist on that country. And my first question on that point is, what do you find more fascinating at this point, or perhaps more skillful, Trump's handling of China or China's handling of Trump?
I'm inclined to think it's probably China's handling of Trump. And the reason I say that is that the Chinese always have a sort of long-term philosophy and a long-term approach. You look at the changes that have been made in that country just over the last 50 years or so. And, you know, without a doubt, there hasn't been we have to do this by next year. We have to do this by next month. We have to do this by next quarter in order for there to be a good stock report, you know, whatever the case might be. They do take a general long-term approach, and that long-term approach almost always means you're going to be very patient. And, you know, as patient as Chinese leaders can be is as impatient as Trump can be. And so when we look at the tariff war or the trade war, I think we can say very carefully that that China has said, okay, you make a move, we're going to respond accordingly. You make the next move, we're going to respond accordingly. We are waiting for you to be the responsible stakeholder. And eventually the Americans did come around and did lead to and that led to the negotiations that took place in Switzerland, which thankfully led to the reduction of most of the tariffs. And so I think the Chinese philosophy in this case of let's wait, I think has worked.
I do want to ask you about this deal because, unsurprisingly, it's been hailed as a great success of historical proportions. But if we look at this deal analytically, it's quite clear that it's temporary, that it's fluid. It gives both sides an opportunity to raise the stakes whenever they want to. So it's like an open relationship with no strings attached. Do you think the Trump administration is capable or even interested in a more durable, more solid forms of interstate agreements?
I think the serious people in his administration are interested in something that is stable, something that is going to be long-term. And I think what they're trying to sort out is the unpredictability of the man at the top of the system, the man who sits in the Oval Office each day. Because, you know, one day he seems to be, let's make this happen, and then it sort of disappears, and there's not a lot of interest, at least, that he shows. You know, take TikTok, for example. He was talking about TikTok incessantly, and then all of a sudden, he hadn't talked about TikTok in weeks and months. 90 days for him seems to be a fascinating and regular policy. You know, we're going to look at this in 90 days. We're going to decide this in 90 days. And so, yes, if the 90-day policy is indeed one that he's going to hold to, that puts his people who are doing these negotiations in a very challenging position because, you know, complex deals can't necessarily be done in only 90 days. I think more so, we also see that the business community in the United States is saying, look, okay, the tariffs have come down, but they're still too high. And if this is going to be, if there's potential for those tariffs to ratchet up again, we're not going to take long-term business decisions. We're not going to buy new products. We're not going to seek to trade. We're not going to seek to invest. And those will have carry-on effects into the U.S. economy that we will see with either job losses or we will see with manufacturing not being developed as it should. And yes, there will be constant fear of whether a sort of angry Trump does something someday that blows up the entire concept of this 90-day window. So there is no doubt that expecting stability from him seems to be a bridge too far.
Okay, well, Professor Moretti, in the spirit of stability and predictability, we do have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Эвакуация техники – это один из элементов технического обеспечения, который направлен на то, чтобы машины, которые застряли либо повреждены в ходе боевых действий, восстановить и вернуть обратно в строй.
Все, побежала как родная.
Закончится война, пойду оператором, буду снимать свадьбу с самолета.
Thank you. If you think about Russia, what does your mind picture? What landscapes open up before your eyes? What wonders can you imagine? Peter Scott starts the journey. Are you ready to come along?
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Anthony Moretti, an associate professor at the Department of Communication and Organizational Leadership at Robert Morris University. Professor Moretti, moving on from China to some of the America's Gulf partners, Trump is fresh from visiting the region, and it's remarkable that the Saudi Arabia and some of its neighbors are very direct and sometimes very literal in their ways of building a relationship with Trump's America, showering him with praise and with presents. Do you think that's an effective strategy?
I think it's an effective strategy because clearly it is something that Trump likes. He likes to be told how great he is. He likes to be told how powerful he is, how strong he is, what a great leader he is. And, you know, and certainly in the United States, there's been so much talk about the suggestion from the Qataris that they'll provide him with a $400 million plane that can be the next Air Force One and travel, you know, and allow him to travel all over the world. You know, I think there's so much conversation about the airplane because it's something we can literally see as it, you know, as it sits somewhere, you know, in Qatar. But, you know, I think it's also a symbol of, again, where the ethics are. And, you know, praise is one thing because praise doesn't have something tangible associated with it. But if that praise does lead to deals that perhaps are more beneficial for the other side because you've softened Trump up a little bit, again, here you see his critics saying, well, you know what, as long as you keep him happy, you can kind of do whatever you want.
But Professor Moretti, on this point, I mean, the United States has a very long tradition of lobbying. And some of that happens behind closed doors in very covert ways. Isn't there a value in bringing that out in the open for everybody to see? And by the way, I mean, one remark that stuck with me is Trump saying that, you know, we give a lot to the rest of the world. Why don't we accept presents? So he puts himself on par with the rest of the world. And that's a value of the United States seeing itself as a you know, as an equal to everybody else. We haven't heard that from any American leader in recent decades. And there is some, I wouldn't say humility in that. I don't think he thinks as deeply as that. But, you know, it does transmit a certain ethos that, you know, we are just like you.
There is no question that over the last 25 years or so, the U.S. foreign policy has taken many body blows, and those body blows, frankly, in many ways have been self-inflicted. You know, reckless wars, continuing to trample on the rights of people in specific regions or countries of the world, a seemingly disregard at home, with domestic policy as well. And so, yeah, I think there is no doubt that. You know, trying to be a little more frank and a little more honest and a little more open might very well work. And, you know, I think, too, the dynamic that we see in the Gulf and throughout the Middle East also is such that there is, again, the recognition that U.S. policy has been so favorable specifically to, you know, to Israel over the over multiple presidents and so or presidencies. And so maybe what we're seeing here as well is an attempt to say, you know, maybe in order for us to get a little bit out of him and to maybe pull him a little bit away from Israel, however impossible that might be, again, based upon what he said about that country. But if we can get a little bit of a better deal out of him because we are patting him on the back and showering him with gifts, let's face it, if that works and the rules of the past have been essentially blown up, then sure, let these rules continue. recognizing, though, that they are going to come with sharp criticism in the United States because, to borrow a cliche, that's not the way we've always done things around here.
Well, Professor Moretti, I think Saudi Arabia and its Gulf neighbors are not just master flatterers, but they are also very important international interlocutors. They played a barely visible yet important role in bringing the Ukrainian peace talks online by organizing the first set of meetings between the Russians and the Americans. And also last year, it was China that brokered a major deal between the Saudis and the Iranians. So there seems to be a whole, you know, series of deals, shady deals underway. I wonder if you see that as, you know, separate phenomena or as part of a larger wave of backdoor negotiations.
Probably too soon to tell, but if I were to take a guess, I'd say that I think this is an intentional effort on the part of the Saudis to ensure that they become a more prominent player, if not only in the Middle East, certainly on the global stage. And, you know, there is no question that as Mohammed bin or MBS has tried to reshape Saudi culture, Saudi business, etc. You know, one thing that he has consistently talked about is, while we reduce how much reliance we have on oil, that means we have to increase and expand our efforts in other areas, whether it's AI and technology, whether it's soft power, whether it's international sports, whether it's culture, whatever it might be. And diplomacy certainly falls into that basket of possibilities as well. So I think what we're seeing from Saudis is a concerted effort to say, maybe just in the Middle East, but hopefully in a larger arena, we are no longer going to be deemed sort of secondary when it comes to conversations. We want people to come to us first when they come to the Middle East. And I think so far it's having benefit, especially, as you mentioned, that ability to both bring peace talks from a conflict not close to home, but also to be a willing partner in trying to have better relations with the Iranians much closer to home.
Now, I want to move now to the Russians and their way of dealing with Trump. We are fresh off the 2.5-hour conversation between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump. And as an observer of the Kremlin politics for two decades, I found it also quite remarkable because on the one hand, Russia didn't budge on any of its strategic points, but the tone of that conversation was very personal, very soft. I mean, President Putin congratulated Trump on the birth of his 11th grandchild. He, you know, made compliments about Melania, etc. What do you think about it? Do you think that's because, you know, I'll tell you what I think. I think the Russian president is not very given to flattery, especially flattery of the Western leadership. And yet somehow he shows his personal softer side more here. Why do you think that is?
You took the words right out of my mouth. I was about to say the same thing, that there is a relationship there that has withstood two presidencies, 8 years, 9 years, almost 10 years now. And there does appear to be a connection that those two men make on a regular basis. Needless to say, here in the United States, recognizing the general public opinion of Russia, especially relating to the conflict with Ukraine, I think the more that he reaches out to Trump, the more frustrated most Americans get, because as he reaches out to Putin, more and more Americans, I think, get frustrated because they think that somehow he's going to sell out the United States in some way. You know, this is part of diplomacy, and you know, I go back to the book that I am reading, War on Peace. You know, you have to talk to both people you like and you have to talk to people you don't like. And that involves countries as well. You know, and there was so much criticism of Trump in his first term when he had conversations with the leaders of North Korea. And there's so much, you know, you can't do this again. You can't go to the border. You can't shake his hand. And Trump did it anyway. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if there are better prospects Architects for Peace, because people with differing opinions on items big and small can talk those out, the better the chance it's going to be.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think we are still at a very early stage of those talks, but I think it's noteworthy that even after the first meeting in Saudi Arabia, both leaders brought up the sort of national layer of their potential cooperation, because they talk not only about their personal opinion of themselves, but also about the potential cooperation in the Arctic or in the energy arena. And I think that's perhaps the second pillar of Kremlin's approach to Trump, to show that there could be some constructive benefits to both nations from this kind of collaborative work. Do you think, though, it's likely to result in anything substantive?
Russia is a powerful, meaningful global, a central global power. And so as a result, the more that it is engaged in with other countries in finding the solutions to some of the world's most complex problems, climate change, food insecurity, the next pandemic, and trying to find a solution to that before it ever starts, all of those kinds of things. If Russia is at the table with the United States, with China, with Western Europe, with a couple of other countries in Asia, with a couple of other countries around the world, that's what we need. We don't need isolation. Yes, it's very easy to say, I don't like that country, therefore I don't want them sitting, at the table. That's not a wise solution. That's not how diplomacy should work. And, my hope, and one of the things that I've said often, is the U.S. and China working together, that's good. The Chinese and Russians working together, that's good. The U.S., the Chinese, and the Russians working together, that's even better, because now you've got three complex societies with lots of brain power coming together. And so, yes, I do hope, especially in the area of energy, it might be the most logical, mm-hmm. but in other areas as well, that we see a definite thaw and a definite improvement in perceptions of Russia and the engagement or the willingness of allowing Russia to engage in these complex conversations, because again, there is enough brain power there to make it happen.
That thought, Professor Moretti, only applies to the United States for the moment, but there is a major obstacle that we are seeing in the European Union, which still seems to be a rather determined to continue with the Ukrainian crisis. And I guess the last question I have for you, do you think Trump has enough leverage to bring the US European partners on board? And what do you think in general about the European approach to Trump? Because as much as the European position is hostile to Russia, I have sympathy for them, because they clearly hate everything Trump says and does. And yet they also have to do something to at least keep the semblance of the transatlantic alliance.
I think one thing that would help immediately is to be much more transparent about its purposes to engage in peace between Russia and Ukraine. I think it's too often been a one-sided argument from the European Union. I think the European Union is in this very weird predicament right now, in that it doesn't want to appear too close to the U.S., it doesn't want to appear too close to China, but it also realizes that it really can't go it alone. It can't be its own pillar. It would need allies in order to make that happen. So I think one of the things it's done, and it's drawn significant criticism in especially pockets in the UK, is to try to carve out separate agreements with Britain and almost bring the UK back into the European Union. That would be great if the UK were the kind of economic power it was a couple of generations ago. It is not right now. And so it almost appears as though the European Union at times is trying to be a third partner, recognizing it is not nearly as strong as the US or China. It might make more sense to find its strengths, to find opportunities to work with both, and to engage in the peace process between Russia and Ukraine in a way that does not make the Russians justifiably fear that the EU is perhaps not being an honest and transparent broker in those conversations.
Okay, well, Professor Moretti, we have to leave it there, but thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for the invite. I appreciate it.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.